Hi.
Hello, 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 hello.
I am Tess.
I am Tess.
No.
No, I'm Max, and this is the Extraordinary Brains podcast.
This is the Extraordinary Brains podcast.
And we are releasing an episode a little bit later than planned.
Because you did have COVID.
I did have COVID, and I was, first of all, a bit poorly. And second of all, we weren't allowed to be in the same room, and we don't really like to record through kind of scratchy Zoom, at least these bits. So we have got an interview for you lovely listeners. We hope you had a good festive season and New Year. I suddenly decided to have a really bad cough. It is with Dr. Ranjita Dittal, who is a lecturer in interdisciplinary health studies. And also neurodiverse, obviously, which is why she has have her on the podcast.
Yes.
I thought it was really interesting. We talked about her history of moving from Nepal to the UK, her experience. I mean, effectively, her parents' experience of racism, although we didn't call it that.
I think there was undertones. Like, it was that bit out.
It was definitely there, wasn't it?
Mm.
It was a really, really, good chat, and lots of thinking about the connections between science and creativity. And she's also, I'll put the link in to the show notes, but she also sort of runs a mailing list of neurodiverse people in the creative who have an interest in interest in science and creativity. So a really, really interesting person and a really interesting thinker about these things. So before I start coughing again, let's get on with the show.
Let's get on with the show. The incredible show.
Welcome.
Welcome.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome to Ranjita Dittal, a lecturer in interdisciplinary health sciences at University College London, a pharmacist and sculptor. Welcome this morning to Extraordinary Brains.
Thank you very much, Max. And hello, Tess. Love you to
see
you
both.
So I think we'll just go straight in with our first question, and Tess, as is traditional, will be posing the questions.
First question. So when you were growing up, when did you become aware of being different to other people, and how was that for you? How did that feel?
Yeah, so it's a really big question, actually, and I can answer it in lots of different ways. So I was born in Nepal, and I came to the UK when I was about 8. And in Nepal, my parents were working as doctors, but in very remote rural areas. And so I had a kind of a different sort of childhood where we were in really kind of sort of open sort of spaces. There's a lot of freedom for me to do what I wanted to do, actually. There wasn't a lot of control put on me as I was growing up, but my mum and dad were both busy. And I was sort of, I was always curious. I didn't like doing the playing things where you were indoors. I was outdoors quite a lot, and I really didn't like school. And I guess I've always felt different in the sense, well, I didn't feel different then because I just thought that was the usual thing. But I've always felt different in many ways. I mean, I'm neurodivergent. I'm severely dyslexic. I have dyspraxia, and I'm going for my ADHD assessment next year. But coming to the UK, I felt different in many ways. I'm a non-white person. I'm Asian. I am female. So when I was a young person in school, I experienced difference whether I had a choice or not. Mm. So,
how old were you when you came to the UK?
So I was about 8 when I came. Okay. So, but also getting used to a new system, new culture in the UK. So it was all kind of, so therefore I was being exposed to new things and adapting, therefore my difference was me coming to a new place as opposed to I'm different because I'm neurodivergent and this, that. So there were lots of differences that I had to explore, and I'm still exploring those things now. But yes, so that's always been part of my growing up.
And how did your parents kind of react to your difference? I mean, were they aware of your difference to other children early on?
And how did they react? And how did they help you through or not help you through that adjustment to coming to the UK?
I think it was very difficult for them as well. And it wasn't a place where, I think the UK wasn't a place that is more sort of culturally aware then. And I think that they were kind of found it hard. They thought that, because I have a younger brother and sister as well, and we have kind of age difference between 3 to 6 years, so that they're both younger than me. So my mum was kind of working as a gynecologist in Nepal, but when she came to the UK, she wasn't working. So it was a huge change for her. She'd never sort of worked, sort of looking after kids full time. We had other people look after us when we were in Nepal growing up. So it was a huge change for her, for the whole family, for every single member of the family. So I guess what was happening and how we were adapting wasn't, we were all kind of experiencing this new space and how to live and how to be. And I think it was a bit of a confusing time for all of us actually. And I think it took some time to things to be settled, and also we moved a lot. I went to lots of different schools. And because my dad's job was being changed from different hospitals, so we kind of followed where my dad was going. And then when we came to London sort of fairly soon, things started to sort of feel more settled, because we didn't leave London, we just maybe go to another part of London.
Yes, well, the advantage of London has got so many different places you can work as a doctor that you can stay in one place and have all sorts of different jobs. It's a shame in a way, because the NHS isn't, well, assuming that was the kind of sector he went into, but the health sector in Britain is not good at offering stability to overseas doctors. We tend to sort of move them around an awful lot, and I think that's sort of doesn't help people to feel welcome, I think.
Yeah, it's also just appreciation of what people have achieved, like the people's skills. My mum and dad were doing a huge amount of work in Nepal with family planning, public health, and they were really kind of recognised and sort of really worked extremely sort of hard. And the idea was my mum and dad were only going to come here for this kind of fellowship for training, and the idea was we were going to go back to Nepal. It wasn't ever to stay. So there lots of things were going on for my parents, and also it affected us as we were growing up too.
Yeah, I mean, I think the sort of, in a way, the sort of coded way that you said that is the skills and experience of overseas doctors are also not appreciated. Mm. And this isn't necessarily relevant to our particular, it may be relevant to our particular discussion, but there is a kind of, there's a prejudice against them and a prejudice against their experience and their skills, which is still, I think, around, which I think probably does have an effect on everyone in the family if you're not, you know, you're not valued, your you know, kind of your huge amount of experience is not valued as a parent. But should we move back to you and go on to our second question?
Yes, we should. So once you realised you were different, what was your process towards understanding that?
Yes, so therefore I wasn't diagnosed with my dyslexia until during my PhD, and that was only about sort of like 13 or 14 years ago. So I went through training as a pharmacist, my GCSEs, A-levels, and my degree, my master's. I practiced clinically in different settings. I didn't know about my neurodivergent. It's only during my part-time PhD, and I self-referred. And I self-referred because I was in the process of completing an NHS ethics application. And I don't know if you've ever completed one of those.
Yeah.
But it's very kind of very, very neurodivergent unfriendly. It's a real barrier for people who are neurodivergent to be involved in research. It actually puts you off. And so when I was in that process, I saw questions that asked me to answer in a certain way, and then it felt and looked very similar to another question, and I just didn't understand it. But leading up to that point, I've always found it hard sort of some things really difficult to do, which but other things not. So there's a very kind of up and down.
So spiky profile.
Classic profile. And so I just thought, oh, that's because I should have been doing arts. You know, I shouldn't have been studying health and sciences and pharmacy. And I just put it down to that during my degree. So when I was doing the PhD, when I had time to focus and explore, there were still things that I found difficult. So I sort of self-referred to the disability services. That was at King's College London, where I did my PhD. And so they said, yes, you've passed the initial screening, so we're going to get an educational psychologist to do a full assessment for you. So yes, I was kind of almost severely dyslexic and sort of dyspraxia, and now I'm sort of understanding more about it, and I've wanting to be assessed for ADHD, which wasn't offered at the time. It wasn't even explored that these things occur together, and it's not just an individual separate thing. It's located in the same part of the brain, our processes and functioning, and so on. So that's how I found out. And so your question was how, I don't know if I've answered your question. The processing towards understanding. So yeah, I guess I've been processing ever since.
Exactly.
And the processing has been in lots of different ways of how I work. I've set up, there's a group that I've set up with a colleague who's also neurodivergent called Neurodiversity in and Creative Research. And then that was about a year ago during lockdown. And just lots of really creative thinkers and researchers, practitioners, artists have joined it nationally and internationally. I think we have about 300 members, and we didn't promote the group. And hearing their stories, they present, we talk, and that's been a way of processing. Just knowing that what I'm saying and what I'm experiencing is actually similar to somebody else, or they understand what I'm, you know, how we're communicating with one another about our experiences. So that's been actually the most important, actually. And also in an international group, I just realized how sort of non-diverse, being neurodivergent, even the community can be.
I know what you're saying.
And, you know, even when I was diagnosed, the education psychologist, it was more of a screening assessment. Here's your result. And I was in huge shock. I was relieved, but there was no sort of aftercare. There's that duty of care when you find out.
Left
totally on your own. And that was a really kind of strange time. That's when I started reading a lot about things myself to find out.
And a lot of it has to be kind of self. And there's lots to unpack about what you've said. Just to go back quickly, you said NHS ethics. Just to be clear, to our listeners who have not gone through the ordeal of an NHS ethics application. So when you want to do research anything to do with the NHS, you have to go through this really unnecessarily complex and, as you say, extremely unfriendly process, which has very little to do with your ability to have creative and interesting research ideas, or actually indeed to do the research of applying for ethical approval that your research is ethical. And it is one of those bureaucratic nightmares that is far more complex than it needs to be. And it is a big barrier to people actually doing research, particularly people like me who are not paid for, who don't have paid research. Actually, if you think about, I've got a really interesting question to answer, the kind of bureaucratic stuff, particularly if you find that it difficult to do bureaucratic stuff, as I do, is a big barrier. And I think the other thing that I've picked up, there's lots of stuff from what you've said, but the lack of diversity within the neurodiverse community. And I've joined your community. I've joined it this morning. We'll post the link. It's an email. It's a really old school email server. It kind of takes me back.
It's not the great Gmail. It kind of, it is a very, we're trying to ch- have different platforms on it, and some of our network members have created Slack and different things. But
But it's good. I like it. It's good. I mean, it's very simple, and then you get emails like that. I can compute that. But there is a lack of diversity within the neurodivergent community. One of the things, you were born in Nepal, but you came here when you were eight. What I really am still looking for is somebody who is still living in a country like Nepal or India or China or, you know, one of these nations where perhaps the understanding of neurodiversity in the medical profession or the health professions isn't advanced, or in culturally is not advanced, and how it feels to be in that situation. And we haven't got that much in the neurodivergent community. And I think the neurodivergent community is very white as well. But that would be my observation. But I don't know if you want to develop your thought, if that's what you meant.
Yes, oh, absolutely. It's a very kind of, you know, like sea of white faces when you go to an event or you are sort of hearing about people's research or work in your like divergent culture and community. And also it's not really talked about the people's experiences in different parts of the world. The idea of being neurodivergent, that sort of framework comes from a Western perspective, you know, the idea, because being neurodivergent in Nepal in some ways could be a really, for me, it was actually a positive time. Because I was a young person, I was a child, and I loved that kind of freedom, and I had the freedom. I don't know, my mum and dad were kind of probably too busy to kind of have rules, so I was able to kind of be in that and create my own rules, in fact. And in some ways, I was like the perfect, really great childhood. I have really positive memories of that, and I think I needed that freedom. If I kind of was in UK, for example, at that time, I would have probably been a problem, so-called problem child, because, when I was at school, then sort of being female, you couldn't have dyslexia. It was a male thing. There was a gender issue
Was that for you in the UK or in the
world? In UK, if I had been a child, you know, a younger person I did come to the UK when I was about eight, but there's huge kind of sort of misinformation about this sort of affects more males and females, it would have been missed in so many ways. But in Nepal, even if people didn't know about neurodivergent or sort of general things about mental health, is just not seen or supported in the same way as in the UK. So it's sort of, I think what I'm trying to say is, even without a diagnosis, a community or a culture can be a space where a neurodivergent person can flourish without it being labeled or diagnosed. It's just the way things are, and that people in Nepal have extended families. There's a kind of more people talk to one another more, and there's more kind of space and freedom to explore. And maybe that suited my kind of my temperament, my growing up at the time. But in your question, Max, it's we don't know a lot about things like that. We don't know how people different parts of the world who are neurodivergent experience things. In the network that I run with, it's a Dr. Kai Sin Tan who kind of co-leads that network with me. We have members from India and China, Far East, who have joined us. Some of them are doing PhDs or researchers. And they've said mental health is, the idea of it is taken from a very biomedical model from the West, but not, and then the things in the East are kind of seen as not significant or important to incorporate or understand. So therefore you're kind of bringing in an alien thing into a culture that already exists, that's rich. So that could be quite damaging.
It's interesting to think what an Eastern conception of neurodiversity, not necessarily a categorical one like a kind of the Western biomedical model of, you know, very categorical, biologically based diagnoses, what would that look like? I mean, I don't know that you'll have the answer, but that's such a fascinating question, isn't it?
Absolutely. We really need to explore that. And I think I'm in the arts and sciences department at UCL. And I just think health, you know, when we talk about neurodivergent experience, I can see it incorporating both the arts and sciences, and many cultures, sort of non-Western cultures, do that naturally. I think there's a lot of kind of the philosophy of health came from the arts. Well, as it did, you know, how we kind of practice health now came from the arts and sciences. It wasn't like somebody was in a lab, now we're going to create health. You know, it happened through community and culture and observation and sort of that evolved. I think it's a really important area to explore it in, for instance, me as a researcher, I use both arts and sciences methods and exploring a phenomena or what's going on, and that gives me a lot of tools to use to look at somebody's experience, what they're saying, what they need, and I learn from them as much as the person is learning, you know, being part of the study. I'm trying to be a participatory sort of action researcher in the way I like to do things. I think
What kind of questions are you answering with your research? What are you looking at?
Okay, so there's a couple of research projects that I'm doing. One of them, so I used to be an addiction specialist pharmacist, and I'm very interested in alcohol problems and how to reduce alcohol harm. When somebody's dependent drinking, it's very hard to support them to change. But it's when somebody's kind of drinking in this middle group, we call them like harmful, hazardous drinker. If you work with such individuals, applying sort of behavioral change sort of interventions, and that motivational interviewing is something that we use. The way we kind of encourage and motivate the individual and help them sort of explore what they do, people usually don't have understand or make links with their drinking and sort of diabetes, for example, or feeling slightly depressed, and the alcohol's making them more depressed, or just sleep not be able to sleep well. So that so I've been looking at how pharmacists could deliver this intervention from the pharmacy. I've just been working on that, and that was my PhD. And then as I was doing that, I became very interested in health space. So health architect, the spaces where these kind of conversations can take place, what's the best way for the practitioner to feel sort of great about working in that space, as well as the patient and what they think about it. So I'm really involving artists and architects to co-design spaces.
Because it feels very different to be in this, in a kind of blank white space, to something that feels a bit more kind of conducive. Is that the sort of thing that you're talking about in the physical space of, or is it to do with where people are, where people are in relation to each other? Are they sitting? Are they standing? Is there a desk between? What sort of thing is that? Are you talking about?
Okay, so health architecture. So it's applying the arts and sciences in the health architecture work that I'm doing, the architecture of pharmacies, it's called. And it's about understanding what is being experienced in those spaces at the moment. Because pharmacy and other kind of health services, when they have been developed, they've only included certain type of thinkers or policymakers or health research people that haven't included artists and sort of creative sort of people who can see the obvious. The space is really not comfortable, and I'm not going to tell you about my health because I feel uncomfortable in this space. Exactly. But if you invited an artist to look at the space, they'll have different views and perceptions of that space, or an architect who was interested in design in that way, who also had an interest in the arts. So you'll come up with so many solutions and possibilities. And that's what I'm doing. I'm using something called experience-based co-design. So we're just at this study currently, we want to know how are people experiencing these spaces? What are the themes? And then the idea is to use that to create a design guide for pharmacies that can be tested in future. So this is a very exploratory sort of stage of the study. And for me, that was an obvious thing. You know, why hasn't pharmacy space, which is the most accessed space in the world, pharmacy is the most accessed health space, been explored? So it didn't feel like a big sort of complicated thing. It was a very simple, obvious thing that hasn't been done.
Exactly. This is one of the best, all the best research questions. I want to take you back because you said that you were diagnosed during a PhD with severe dyslexia.
Yes.
So how did you get that far to get to doing a PhD? And it interests me because presumably you had some literacy or other difficulties in school. What were they ascribed to, and how did people not spot that you were severely dyslexic?
Yeah, I think it goes down to I think I was seen as being a good pupil. I was probably well behaved. When I came to the UK, I was well behaved. In Nepal, I was not. Sort of, I was kind of quite a one. I had quite a lot of freedom, and I didn't. I was. It's strange. I was so disruptive in school in Nepal that I was put in my own room, separate from other people, because I was. I really can't remember what I actually did in the classroom that in Nepal, the why. But when I came to the UK. I think there's a shock of being in a new place. I became naturally quieter. I was just bewildered by everything. So I think, but I was also seen as being I think this is what happened. My English, I was still, I wasn't really, really fluent in English as other students in my year. And I think they probably put it down to, she's developing her English language, her sort of, and so on. So the dyslexia was sort of hidden, invisible, and therefore it wasn't even sort of seen or thought about.
And that can persist for a number of years, even when actually, if you actually talk to the young person, they're perfectly good at English, but it's put down to this phrase EAL, English is an additional language, for a long time at schools. Mm. And I mean, I pick up kids and I'm like, this is not EAL, seriously. So I think that's one. And then I suppose also moving from school to school, it takes that time for someone to pick up, hang on, what's going on here? Why is it, why are you having difficulties? But it's astonishing that you managed to get as far as a PhD before. I mean, let's just mark that.
I mean, congratulations.
Thank you, Tess.
Go on. And you're thinking about ADHD. What turned you on to the possibility that you might, as well as dyspraxia and dyslexia, we need to talk about dyspraxia. What turned you on to the idea that you might have ADHD as well?
Yeah, because I discovered my dyslexia during the PhD, but I was doing a PhD, I was very focused on something. I was very interested in something, but it was a part-time PhD. So I was sort of working a bit at the same time. But going into the world of work after the PhD, being a postdoc and then a lecturer in another university, and now I'm at UCL here, realized actually I'm doing some really interesting things. I'm really enjoying it, but I'm really finding it hard to focus.
Yeah.
And I think, why is that? Because this is really exciting. I mean, it's arts and sciences and all things I really like doing. And this is taking me so much longer to do, but this is actually not that big deal to do. I can't focus. So it was things like that. And also it wasn't made explicit to me when I was first diagnosed that also, in the report, it was like, maybe there's some attention things happening here. They said in a very vague way, not helpful. But learning sort of myself about it, I probably do. I'm most definitely. I saw myself in it in the descriptions of ADHD and how it was described.
Okay, and I just want to ask about sculpture, because you mentioned that you're diagnosed with dyspraxia, which is a condition where there's often, by definition, difficulties with aspects of motor coordination and also planning, sequencing, and so forth. And sculpture is inherently about, to an extent, is a motor skill which requires planning and sequencing. So I'm not saying this is not a paradox, but it's really fascinating that you both have dyspraxia and a passion for sculpture. And how did that come into your life? And how do you kind of make sense of that with your dyspraxia?
Yeah, I've always loved art, and I would have been happy to study it. I was very interested, and it was I kind of took little courses during my kind of degree and things like that, even when I was at school. It was actually during the PhD I enrolled in this really, really amazing college called Morley College. It's in Lambeth, it's in London, and it's an adult education college. And I started with abstract painting. I just did something playful, which was so different from the PhD, because it wasn't about this sort of methodological working and very kind of precise and systematic.
Yeah.
This abstract was very free and very colourful, and the tutor was excellent because she incorporated texture. She really made us be playful, and it wasn't about accuracy or precision. So this thing really kind of connected with me, and then my pieces became more and more 3D because I kept adding lots of things into my canvas, and then they wouldn't hold anymore. They kind of became really so after a couple of terms there, I joined the sculpture course in the same place at Morley, and it was really lovely. The space, the art studio, the sculpture studio, is such an amazing space. It feels like it could be 100 years ago that you walked into another time, because it's not a very modern space, that's why, but it does have electricity, and it can be a bit warm, not particularly warm in the winter. It's got this really kind of a magical space where you can do woodwork, metalwork, clay, all sorts of materials. People are using and creating things with materials all in the same space.
Yeah.
And all of that was going on. And therefore, yes, I have dyspraxia, but there was something about maybe the tutor. She, I just wanted to make something with metal. And then she said, oh, well, why don't you kind of do some plasma cutting there in the machine? So I was gowned up with my sort of visor and everything, and I was cutting metal, but I would never think about, I don't want to use that machine, that's so complicated, I might, you know, that's going to be really difficult to use. But because I was sculpting, I just went into it and did it, and created a metal sculpture and made it another one, and then different materials. So there was something about a freedom of a space that you can do so much more than you think you can.
Yeah.
And when I think about that, I think, oh, that wasn't me. How did I do that? And I have this really strange paradox when I say, well, how did you manage to do a PhD? And I, this is me talking to myself. You know, how did you do that? And then how did you make this sculpture? Because here I'm stuck at my desk and I can't even write these two sentences. You know, I'm really, really stuck. How did I do that? So I feel things like that when I've moved to a new space. I've started a new job at UCL, and I look back thinking, because I'm trying to settle in, so I think, well, how did I manage to do that in the past? You know, is that a disbelief? It's so strange. And it's the art has been a really therapeutic experience during my PhD. I think it got me through the program and also helped me to reevaluate my bringing the arts and the health together into my research, which was very separate before. And it kind of made me think, oh, well, it's possible, and I can see the value in it. Mm. And I can find ways of bringing it in and becoming open to that.
I think that's really interesting, isn't it? And it's almost like, because often with dyspraxia, it's not that you can't do the things, it's that you can't do them quickly and accurately according to societal expectation. But of course, in that art space, the only expectation that matters is your own expectation, your own pace. So maybe that's a crucial difference that makes it kind of and makes it a space where you can explore in a kind of physical way, which it might be more difficult in kind of typical world. I don't want to say real world, because there's no such thing as real and unreal. A typical world, you know, kind of norm world.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I think that kind of learning, that space, is so important for neurodivergent sort of expression.
Tess, because you're quite a big fan of art and creative
things. I do love art, but I feel like I don't have the freedom of time in art.
Because you do it as a subject.
Because I do it as a subject in school, and the lack of the freedom of time makes it very stressful, and it kind of takes that more therapeutic aspect away from it.
Yeah, because you do enjoy it when you have the time to do it. The holidays, actually. You do quite a lot of art on the holidays, actually.
I struggle to do artwork at home because I struggle to focus and do... academic stuff that I perceive as academic in a non-academic setting.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure, but we do have a lot of freedom with creativity because we have all sorts of resources there. I'm looking into trying wood burning.
Ooh.
Which is very interesting. I think I might do sculpture for my next final project.
There you go, see?
Who knows? I think it would be a very different kind of sculpture, though. But
yeah. I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Because schools can take really beautiful and wonderful things like literature and art and make them not fun and a bit of a chore.
No, because my school is really good with art. It is really good, and I love my teacher. But everyone else is so much faster than me. And I'm just kind of sat there on my first analysis, and everyone else has done three.
Yeah.
And they've done three inspired pieces and three analyses, and I've only done the first analysis, and that's it. And I don't know. I don't really feel like I have that freedom of time that you were talking about, but yeah, sorry.
No, I think it's really interesting. Well, sort of, because you expect someone with ADHD to be quick, but sometimes we're slow.
I am very slow.
it's like watching you eat. Right, third question.
So how do you feel about your difference now, and what impact does it have on you, like in a positive way or negative way, or maybe both?
No, thank you. I think now I'm sort of more, I have more awareness of myself and others who are neurodivergent, and I've kind of got myself into probably work and sort of culture and communities that understand this a lot more. I'm very open about it in my work, actually. I've tell people in my department, and I think it's so important that in the world of work, neurodivergent people, that we know the stats is terrible, being in employment, being recognized, not overlooked for promotion and doing well in your field. A majority don't. There are the exceptions, and we hear about these exception people, but it's still not a great place. In academia, much even worse, reading and writing. And then why are you going to academia? It's still a very, very hostile place for many people, particularly of the stories we hear from this neurodivergent network, the creative research network that Kai and I run. And it's just really heartbreaking and unnecessarily kind of, it's so simple if you just made the adjustments slightly at work, it's not even the word adjustment, it's just kind of being open to different ways of working. And if you're slow at something, is not because you might be seen as being slow, but actually you're doing loads and other things in your mind and your thoughts, and you're totally sort of absorbed in it, and that absorption is a real kind of who is that passionate or committed to something, and very, very few people, and it's not appreciated. So your question, I've kind of I still struggle with things. I still question, is this the right thing for me to do? Mm. But I think the idea that I can bring the arts and sciences together in my research and even teaching, like we have workshops with my students, the master's students, where we do kind of art creative workshops to understand different concepts of research processes. Mm. And sort of, it's such a great way of learning. It then stimulates interest to kind of read things about it, connect ideas, and really develop the research methods and the range of methods that are available to a person. And they're creating their own tools, and then it's got creative research process. So I kind of love, yeah. Sorry.
Do you think your neurodiversity makes it easier for you to blend the artistic and scientific worlds and kind of find, so that sounds like a really good example of a bridge between the two.
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. I think what when we're neurodivergent, we try to look for solutions. We're working so hard that you need to find anything that will work. So therefore, your usual barriers for maybe a neurotypical person of, this is my world, that's somebody else's world, I will not go there, and that's, this is me, I'll feel uncomfortable with that. It's almost sort of being neurodivergent, you almost sort of, you have to kind of really kind of look for anywhere, everywhere, what's going to work. You kind of almost, you have to kind of give up these barriers and so on, they can't be there. You need to take risks, and I think maybe we take more risks and we bring things that are not related because it makes sense to us. It helps us to get from A to B, or just to move forward with something, or we see something of possibility and opportunity that maybe neurotypical people cannot see, and it feels at home for us. You know, this is we've created the home because I've removed all these barriers and I've connected so and so, and now I feel comfortable with it. Now I can work, or I'm working on this. But yeah, definitely, absolutely. I think we have, you know, ways of seeing and doing and creating things that are very unique, and I don't think it has not been understood as much as it should be.
Mm. Should we have a fourth question?
That's a brilliant idea. Sorry. So looking back at your entire journey from, you know, when you moved to England before that and until now, is there anything that you wish had been different?
No, thank you. I think that's a really good question. I think quite a few things. I wish schools back then were more knowledgeable and aware, and not just aware, but they had things in place that they could action to support students, young people who coming over from another country, struggling with adapting to the language and culture, but also there's other things that student, the young person, is experiencing and is assumed that is not, and also kind of, you know, just because I was well behaved in school in the UK, it was, you know, in primary school, secondary school, it was just not there in place to have a diagnosis. I think that would have made a big difference. I'm just thinking about my life if I had been diagnosed, you know, as a young person, and because I went into university and all of that is only during my PhD much later. So I kind of, and also I wish that after the diagnosis there'd been more support in place. And you know, I was left on my own to explore, and then I finally had the most amazing dyslexia tutor, Peter Lee, and he kind of really kind of, I love the way he got me through the PhD. It was basically translating. I would say my supervisors have said this, I have no idea what that means, and we would talk about it and said, oh, that's probably what they mean, and we would create something, and it was, then we'd have to go back to them, and it was actually better than what they said, you know, pretending to something else, and it was something they hadn't thought about. But having that support, I think, is really important to be in place. And I think I wish that was in place for a lot more people. I think I was very lucky to have that. And also the world of work, you know, people need to really understand that we all work in different ways. The economy and businesses are missing out on not supporting people who think differently, especially the way the world is right now. And also that kind of interdisciplinarity, thinking in different ways. We're not just discipline focused. I think that we need to open that, because it suits us as neurodivergent people. We cannot, some of us are really good at focusing, but I think we draw in experiences and inspirations from different things. We like to mix and match.
Exactly, yeah.
And therefore the world of work should be more open to that.
Mm-hmm. Excellent.
I suppose that probably links in quite well with the final question, which is, what are your hopes for the future?
Oh, yes. I just hope I'd like to see more people who are neurodivergent to really sort of be really open, be comfortable to be open, because that's such a big ask. You know, I hate the equality, diversity, inclusion meetings with, oh, Ranjita's neurodivergent, maybe she can talk about her experience. You know, sometimes I do that and sometimes I don't, but it's such a big, you know, it takes so much out of you. But for the future is, you know, to hear and learn from these stories, and a world that is really positive about differences in lots of different ways. You know, the fact that neurodivergent people are experiencing a huge amount of discrimination means that so are people like from different backgrounds, ethnicities, and cultures, being a gender. You know, and there's so much. So in the future, I think intersectionality, because I experience lots of discrimination, knowingly or unknowingly, because of who I am, and as many others do from what I know and what I read, and I think that is a real, you know, that creates, it's such a loss of everything. You know, you lose out. Everybody loses out in that kind of practice and working and knowing. So my hope for the future is that we can just be ourselves and we can find ways of being ourselves better. I think it's not just a passive thing that you can just be yourself, but you need that tools and connections and being with people and seeing what is possible to be yourself. And that responsibility of now you're being diagnosed, now you can find out who you are. I think that's harmful. I think that's dangerous. You need to have support to find out and explore these things.
I think that's really interesting, isn't it? Because you sometimes as a diagnostician, someone who gives diagnoses, we kind of kid ourselves that giving people information about their diagnosis is going to empower them. But you're right, without further conversations, either by you or within a supportive group, that is not going to happen. It's just a piece of information floating in the ether. And I think the other point that you make is really important is this intersectionality. And it's a long, slightly unfortunate, it's become quite loaded, hasn't it? But it's a really simple, I think it's a really simple concept that different forms of disadvantage are multiply. And I'm greater than the sum, you know, if you kind of have they multiply up. So the more different kinds of disadvantage you have within a society, those are, you know, that makes it multiplicly, you know, they kind of exponentially, that's the word I'm looking for, they're exponentially combined to make things more difficult for you. And it's just a really, it's sort of really basic concept, but you apply that to neurodiversity and then you look at the people who are neurodiverse who are also in other protected, you know, other groups that are disadvantaged, and thinking with people about that is such an important part of it, which is why it goes back to the neurodiverse community being undiverse is a big problem even in the UK, I would say.
Oh yes, definitely. It's not sort of you know, I can't see myself in it is what a lot of people say who are from I know there's somebody who's a white female talking about their experience in America. Well, I don't relate to that part. And there's some things I connect to, but they're not, there's something different from me. It's still something else. Therefore, maybe my problem isn't really that important, or maybe it's, it doesn't exist. Maybe I'm imagining it, you know, that's the sort of thing, and that's not good. And yeah, it's just that compounding effect. The intersectionality hasn't been understood and people don't know how to talk about it. You know, they don't know how to listen up to it or empathize with it. And therefore, if none of that's there, people are not going to feel safe or to know that it even exists for themselves. And I think as neurodivergent people, we really have to work so hard to find out what is going on, who we are, much, much more to gain insight into your own self. So like UCL, we have just started a little reading group for neurodivergent sort of, we're now going to change it. We're going to call it information group, data group, because we're going to look at films as well and audio. But it's sort of reading and writings about neurodivergent culture, but not directly linked, but it's sort of clues about who we are from a cultural perspective and why, and we're kind of exchanging ideas. That's not written in, like, I'm a pharmacist, and when you look at the British National Formulary for Treatment for ADHD, the wordings, I know it's so stark, saying the disorder, treatment, and it's, you know, it's quite appalling, the language, actually, and this is me as a pharmacist saying this, it's really... it's not good. So we're trying to create another language, a way of speaking about it. And I think that's so important. And I don't think there's enough of that, of how we describe ourselves from us, how we want to talk about ourselves, how we want others to talk to us.
It may be a little bit more advanced in the autistic community, but certainly in the ADHD community, such as it is, it's really not made any progress very much at all. And I suppose that's a hope for the future, isn't it? That the kind of the other neurodiverse communities, other than autism, which is very advanced in their conversation, kind of start to have those conversations as well. I think that might be a good place to stop, do you think, Tess?
All right.
Unless you've got anything else?
No, I don't think so.
So, so where can people find you if they want to find out more about what you're up to? We'll post a link to your neurodiversity and creative research network with the show notes. But you're on Twitter, is that right?
Yes, I'm on Twitter. I use it very much, but you're very welcome to join. But I think that the network would be great if you wanted to, the Neurodiversity in and Creative Research. It's a really vibrant community, and we're developing a book proposal at the moment, and it's just been really exciting. And yeah, and the network is great because we do events sometimes and people talk about their work, and it's a really lovely kind of, the way we talk about the work is very different from presenting it to at an event or like a usual event or a conference, and it's such a lovely energy when we meet. So everyone, you know, very welcome to join the network. I think that's probably the best place.
Excellent, great. So Ranjita Dittal, thank you very much. Thank you for joining.
Thank you very much. Lovely to see you both. Bye.
Bye bye.
Okay.
Okay, so that was Ranjita. Tess, what are you up to today?
I'm going to my friend's birthday. Happy birthday, Anaya. And then I may be going to my other friend's birthday. Happy birthday, Ryan.
And I was thinking about that this morning. I was thinking what a normal weekend it is, me taking teenagers around the country to different parties.
Hey, not that kind of party.
No, but it's a party, and I think it's good. Anyway, so that's a sort of really lovely emblem of what we hope is a return to normal. We hope everyone's lives
It's not going to be, though.
Well,
it's not going to be.
We'll see. I'm just
a couple months later, Boris will be up partying in his house again.
Oh, a little bit of satire for Saturday morning. Yes. So we hope everyone's lives are returning somewhat to normal.
Yes.
We have some special episodes for parents and partners, which will be slightly different in format. But we will be sort of releasing those in drips and drabs. We've got a couple of other things.
By we, you mean you and sometimes me.
You and, yeah, you won't be there for all of those. That's true.
So it'll be a special surprise if I show up.
Special guest, Tess Davey.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we will see if anyone wants to come on who's listening. Just drop us a note at extraordinarybrainspod@gmail.com. And we're on all
email.
The socials. Oh yeah, we've got our own. Yes, we've got our own email. I've said
we're
it.
We're not on
every
all the
website.
Socials. Should we get Snapchat?
No. No.
We should get Snapchat. Come on.
Okay, fine. I don't really know why.
No,
you
I'm
would
kidding.
Do that.
Let's not do that. Please, let's not do that.
Okay. And Extra Brains Pod is where we are at. So anyway, without further ado, we're going to wonder what the dog's got in his mouth, and we're going to say goodbye.
Bye bye. Well, until next time.
Oh, yeah. Until next time. Not forever.
Yeah.
Bye.